Good morning and welcome to all. We are delighted that you're here. We simply do not take for granted that you have spent your time this morning with us. You are here by choice, whatever it is that has brought you here, whatever specific circumstances have led you to our door. You have thought about it ahead of time. You have planned to be here. You have prepared to be here. And that is in itself an encouragement to us. We're thankful that you have come to worship with us this morning. Hope already that your time has been well spent, that you have seen the value in what we've done this morning, that you've been edified, instructed, encouraged, and that our God, chiefly, above all else in importance, that our God has been pleased with what we have done this morning. You can be turning in your Bibles to Hebrews chapter 11. I'll invite you to do that, please. Hebrews chapter 11 is where we're going to be studying from this morning. Moses was, in the eyes of the Jews, the greatest man in the history of their people. He really did not have a peer among the national heroes of the Hebrews. He has continued to cast a shadow, of course, even today. There are young children, there are babies born every year of very many nationalities who still are given the name Moses. Major Hollywood studios have made feature films and cartoons about Moses, even recently. He, of course, loomed large over the Holy Scriptures of the Jewish people. The author of the first five books, the mediator of their law, and the human agent of some of the most memorable stories and records of antiquity. Aside from that, he was at the center of many legends. Moses is a favorite character if you read much of the extra-biblical Jewish literature. A lot of those stories center around Moses and things that he supposedly did, or ways even after his death that he might have factored into events. Josephus and others stretch some events of his life into myth. That historian in particular records Pharaoh giving baby Moses after his daughter had brought Moses before him. Josephus tells us about Pharaoh giving young boy Moses a royal crown and then the infant taking that crown and throwing it down. We've seen babies do that. But Moses threw that crown down on the ground and then trampled over it and really just showed his disdain for that from a young age. Well, I don't know that any of that happened, but the Jews love telling and sometimes fabricating stories about Moses. In the book of Hebrews, Moses has already been mentioned and discussed at some length, and fittingly in our text, Hebrews chapter 11, as well as the first time that Moses is mentioned in the book, back in chapter 3 and verse 2, we see perhaps his primary importance to the Christian. His primary importance to people like you and me. Here, he is not discussed as the lawgiver. He is not the great prophet. He is not the best or the mightiest among God's men. He is simply, though certainly, another good example of someone who lived by faith. Last week in our time together, we studied from this same chapter, Hebrews 11, and looked at dying faith. We didn't mean by that faith that was weakening, that was diminishing. We instead looked at the faith of dying men, the confidence and trust in God that were possessed by three patriarchs who were facing their very last days. Isaac, Joseph, Jacob, men who had faith that outlived them. We saw that a key characteristic of biblical faith is that it believes that there is nothing which can impede God's purpose and His promises. Even our own deaths will not frustrate His will. And thus they looked forward, and as verse 13 says of them, they died in faith, believing God's promises. Well, the faith of Moses is shown for us and described beginning in verse number 23 of this chapter. There are five particular actions that are described. One is actually performed by the parents of Moses. And then the final one actually concerns the entire nation of Israel, the faithful of all of the people. But note these actions, beginning in verse 23 of Hebrews chapter 11. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents, because they saw he was a beautiful child, and they were not afraid of the king's command. By faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward. By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. By faith he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, lest he who destroyed the firstborn should touch them. By faith they passed through the Red Sea as by dry land, or as the Egyptians, attempting to do so, were drowned. We note these five actions that describe, that symbolize and denote the faith that Moses lived out, the faith that he exemplified throughout his life. Again, that is perhaps his chief importance in this book. He is described as one who is faithful to God, one who lived by that faith. And first of all, in verse 23, we see his being hidden by his parents. That verse and the passage in Exodus both imply that there would be strict punishments for any who violated this edict of the king. You remember that all the male children of the Hebrews were to be killed. They were to be put to death. Pharaoh was worried that he was going to have a problem on his hands with these Hebrews who were growing in number daily. And so any young male child that was born among them was to be put to death. There seems to have been some great risk to the parents in not following through with this. We think of our mothers today, as Brother Beltran mentioned before we began our worship service this morning, and Moses certainly had more to thank his parents for than most. I am glad my mother gave birth to me, but she didn't have to hide me when the doctor came into the room and say, "Well, I think he was going to kill you if I'd let him see you." Moses was certainly a man who had a lot to owe to his parents, Jochebed and Amram. They likely risked their lives to save his. If that seems an obvious thing for a parent to do, remember that not all Israelite families did so. And certainly, many do not, given the choice today. They had faith, the Spirit tells us. Faith that their beautiful son, apparently striking visually in such a way that they believed him to be marked for some kind of a prominent life, they had faith that he would survive, faith that God's people would ultimately prevail under evil circumstances, confidence to do the right thing. Well, Moses chose a true reward for himself. He was raised by a Pharaoh in a Pharaoh's house, by Pharaoh's daughter rather, we should say, but in the household of the king of Egypt itself. We can't say exactly which Pharaoh this would have been to give an exact definite identity of which one of these men it would have been. But this entire time period in Egypt's history, from the 16th century BC to the 11th century, those 500 years of history during which the Exodus certainly would have fallen, the 18th and 19th and 20th dynasties of the Egyptian kings, this is a period referred to as the New Kingdom. And that period in Egypt's history is the richest and most prosperous and most powerful that ancient and powerful nation ever achieved. You think of all of the most well-known pharaohs and the treasures of their burial places that we have uncovered. Familiar names: Ramses, Thutmose, Amenhotep, Tutankhamun, young King Tut, Akhenaten. These would all reign and amass great treasures during the New Kingdom period. Again, what we see that they buried their dead with, what we see that simply has survived for 3,000 years, puts to shame the wealth of many nations today. This is what Moses grew up with. This is what he knew. This is what he stood to inherit. But all of that, pleasures, as the text says, treasures, dynastic honor, Moses spurned all of those things. Instead, what did he choose? Affliction and reproach. The mention of Moses having grown up there in verse 24, the New King James says, when he became of age, seems to be pointing out to us that this was not Moses acting out like a rebellious teenager. Like many kids who have run away when they're 7 years old and they think they're being abused by their parents and they make it down to the end of the block. I did that a couple of times. Say, I'm going to run away. And I did run away. About six houses down. And then thought, I don't know that I have a good long-term plan for this. Maybe I'll end up going back tonight. That wasn't Moses deciding that he would not be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. This was a man who was nearing his 40th year of living who decided that he would not be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Someone who had come of age. This is the reasoned faith of a mature man. Well, this faith also led Moses to leave Egypt in verse 27. Rather, that refers to his initial abandonment of Egypt and going to the land of Midian, or in leaving during the Exodus with the rest of the nation. The point is the same. The writer tells us that Moses forsook Egypt. That's a word that refers to leaving with no intention of coming back. He's forsaking it. He is done with it. And it tells us further that he did so with no fear. Pharaoh's threats, Pharaoh's power did nothing to him. They did nothing to impact the way that he viewed things and the way he viewed his duties. And he endured many difficulties upon leaving, but he did so with confidence in the God who called him and who continued to lead him. Well, this faithful Moses also kept the Passover in verse 28. And that is an interesting moment in Israel's history, is it not? That first Passover. I can't really remember hearing and reading about that event for the first time in my life. I was much too young, really, now to remember when I might have heard this story for the first time. I would be willing to guess, though, that it's not a story that made much sense to me. Because I can imagine that for an adult hearing this the first time, the story would not really make sense to you. The Lord is going to pass by in the night, and he is going to slay the firstborn of all in the land, except for those who have applied the blood of the Passover lamb correctly upon the doorpost. Is that logical? Does that really make any sense from a human perspective? Why would that spare them? Does blood have any natural powers against home invasion? Does that have anything that in itself is going to stave off some destroying entity? For that matter, could God even take the firstborn of Egypt as promised? Think of the people that are being given this instruction. They've seen God's power in 9 plagues already, but this seems to be stretching it. He's going to destroy the lives of all these Egyptians just simply in a night. Can he even do that? Are we even sure that we will be saved if he does that? Can he really pick out that well which one has obeyed and which has not? There's a lot of confidence that goes into the keeping of that first Passover. It goes totally against all logic. It goes totally against any human device or design. But despite that, Moses took God at his word, kept the commandments that had been given to him, and encouraged all of his people to do so as well, by his faith, by his confidence in God. And we see Moses as well passing through the Red Sea in verse 29. Along with the people, Moses walked in dry land through a path in the sea. Those waters, Exodus tells us, standing like walls on either side, as they went through what had previously been a body of water. Again, what would those people have been thinking? Can you imagine? Can you put yourself in their shoes? Is this an illusion? Is this even really happening? Am I actually seeing these walls of water on either side. Is that actually dry ground down there? I mean, that should be the floor of the sea. There should be muck and all kinds of things there. In fact, it should just be deep water that would drown me if I were to walk out into it. Is this going to hold? Wouldn't that be an eerie feeling? Beth and I not long ago, went to the aquarium in Tulsa, and they have one of those kind of underwater type areas where you walk through a hallway that has the tank with the sharks, of course. They always pick the scariest, you know, the naturally scariest animal that they can find to kind of put you in the middle of. But you walk through those halls that have water above you in an area where you're not used to seeing water to your sides and over above you. And that's kind of a strange feeling. You just think, I hope this was well made. I hope someone who knew what they were doing was responsible for designing this. You walk out into the middle of that Red Sea and water is standing like walls on either side. Well, let me rephrase that. I'm not walking out into the Red Sea. I'm sprinting. I am setting the world record time for whatever distance that would take to clear it. I'm running at a fast clip. I am getting through there. Those people, with the Egyptian army breathing down their necks, the Egyptians who are enraged at the loss of their slave workforce and the ruinous plagues that the Hebrews God had afflicted them with, at that last moment, at a desperate moment, God has shown a way to safety. And Moses shows his faith by leading the people through that open door, even in what must have been a terrifying ordeal. Walking through with the eerie water standing on either side with the army at your back. Moses leaves an impressive legacy of faith. Who can benefit, though, from his example? As we consider him this morning, as we consider the life of this man, who is it? Who is it among us who needs a faith like Moses? When do we need a faith like Moses? What situations find us needing to follow this example and live this kind of faith that this chapter tells us without which is impossible to please God? We need the faith of Moses when we have to make difficult decisions regarding the welfare of our children. Now, we are unlikely to face the exact same circumstances that Amram and Jochebed faced. That is an unlikelihood in our lives, as I mentioned a moment ago, that we will have someone who is standing at the door, perhaps, saying, okay, it is time to hand over your child. We're going to kill it. That's a terrible thought, a horrifying thought. But is it at all hard to think of times when our parents will find their faith tested in regards to choosing the best thing for their children? Times when hard decisions will come up. How do we respond? How do we deal with those things? Here's a father who must decide who his kids are allowed to associate with, what movies they can't watch, what music they can't listen to, what parties they can or cannot attend. Here's a mother who makes it a priority that her children obey her and respect her, even when that means that she can't just be the cool friend mom that everyone seems to want so badly. Here's the parent who is not supported in spiritual things by an unbelieving spouse, but who nevertheless makes sure that those children study their Bibles and attend services and have a strong example in their lives. Those are difficult things to do. Those are difficult things for parents to do. I don't know those things. I have to give the caveat as a non-father. I don't know those things are difficult, but I know they are. Godly parents must at times make agonizing decisions in how the children are raised and how the children are educated and how the children are protected. They must make those difficult decisions that are ultimately for their good, even when it is difficult, parents, especially when it is difficult, make the choice that leads to your kids growing spiritually. That we do because of our faith. That we do only with our faith. Because we don't make difficult decisions because they're fun. No, they're tough. It's easy to choose the easy road. It's easy to choose the road that is least resistance and will make us happy right now, or will make things easy right now, or will make the kid happy right now. But the faithful parents choose ultimately what is best for the child. Have the faith necessary to do so. It will be worth it in the end. We must live by the faith of Moses when we are simply afraid. See how much of this passage, those seven verses that we read together, see how much the writer deals with overcoming fear. Moses' parents, he says in verse 23, were not afraid of the king's command. Moses, he says later, did not fear Pharaoh's wrath, nor did he fear losing wealth and luxury when he decides that he will no longer be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. The Israelites did not have to fear God who destroyed the Egyptian firstborn. And they set aside any fear, any trepidation that they might have had, and took those first steps out into the newly dried sand and ground of the Red Sea. Faith overcomes fear. That does not mean that we will not be afraid, that we will not face things in our lives that make us quake and quail and tremble. Even some of the things that these people faced, that the men and women described in Hebrews chapter 11, some of the things that they are up against, we might face those today. Think of Moses and his parents having to deal with Pharaoh, with this tyrant, with this face of a government that was against its own people. Might we today, in some cases, have to face a government that might with little notice prove to be hostile to select groups of its own citizens? I hope it doesn't happen. I don't know that it will happen, but it certainly might. It has happened in the past, even in our own country. Does faith prepare us for that thing which we might fear? Think of parting with earthly family as Moses did when he left Pharaoh's house, decided that he would no longer be considered the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Not an easy thing, I'm sure. Had others who had been raised as his relatives, perhaps. Had all of those things that made that life comfortable and easy and luxurious. But he decided to abandon all of those things and left. Many, I know, today, even here, many wrestle with the problems that come from unbelieving family members. Be it a spouse, parents, siblings, children, that can be so painful, so hurtful, so damaging. We have fear. How are we going to get through it? How are we going to influence those people? How are we going to stay strong when they are trying to weaken us, when they might be actively working against us? Faith overcomes that fear. Sometimes we may just feel like those Israelites in Exodus 13, backed up to the Red Sea. Here comes the Egyptian army. Right in front of us is water that we can't all get across. Can't swim across the sea, and we can't bring our animals and our children. What did you think you were doing, Moses? You brought us out here to die. You brought us out here to get killed. We had it good back there. Already they were starting with that nonsense. Should have just stayed. Sometimes we feel like that in life, don't we? Trouble mounting on every side and no escape route visible? Maybe it's health situations. Maybe it's financial woes. Maybe it's a job that makes us miserable. Maybe it is that home life that is just difficult to live in every single day of our lives. We feel like there is no way out. We have fear. But the Christian has this response. He has the antidote to fear, and that is his faith. The 27th Psalm, "The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear?" The words of Jesus ringing out from the mountain as he delivers his sermon, "Do not worry about tomorrow." The wise words of Peter the apostle in 1 Peter chapter 5, "Cast all your cares upon him, for he cares for you." Repeatedly, these passages, among many others, remind us of our God and his power and his love for us and his concern for us and his promises towards us and the provision that he will give. No matter what comes in this life, we have the promise of his power working on our behalf, of his aid that he gives in time of need, and ultimately of eternal life with Christ. That question that the psalmist asks, a rhetorical question, is a good one to consider. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is my light and my salvation. What is there to be so worried about? When we are afraid, we need the faith that Moses had. What if we are simply tempted by something that sounds a lot better than it really and truly is? Moses had options available to him. He had perhaps incredible wealth, a life of ease. Maybe, depending on how things ended up shaking out in the royal court, maybe even a life of being worshipped as a god himself, practiced among the Egyptians, and not unheard of at all for someone who was raised as Moses was in the Pharaoh's house to receive that honor eventually himself. But see his wisdom. What does he deem those things in verse 25 of our passage? The passing pleasures of sin. Oh, it sounds good now. It sounds like something I might be interested in. But what is it really? Twice in this passage, the author mentions the vision of Moses, the way he saw things. He tells us, first of all, that he looked to the reward when he was spurning those passing pleasures of sin. He will tell us later in forsaking Egypt that he endured as seeing him who is invisible. These are the eyes of faith that are not earthbound, that are not short-sighted, that are not caught up in what happens right here and right now. Faith teaches us to look forward, to think spiritually, to think about what is real. We will all face all sorts of baited hooks dropped into the water right there in front of us, made seemingly especially for us, tailored to exactly what I want right now at this moment by Satan. The writer will describe these later in chapter 12 and verse 1. He'll describe these as the sin which so easily ensnares us. Isn't that an apt way of viewing it, of seeing it? Something that easily tangles us up, ensnares us, traps us. And it's easy sometimes for our adversary when we are not looking ahead and paying attention and really and truly weighing the options before us, because the bait is appealing. It always is. What's Moses dealing with? Treasures and pleasures and honor. Those things are good. They're fun. I mean, the word itself, pleasure, that means you're going to enjoy it. It's something you want right now. The bait is appealing, and it always, always is. A teenager, I don't have any doubt, will have fun getting drunk or smoking a joint with their friends. Yeah, that's a fun thing to do for a young person, probably. That coworker that you are looking at very well might give you more attention in every way possible than your wife does. That might just be the factual state of matters. Cutting ethical corners might save you or might give you real tangible money. Not just a few cents. Something real. Something you can put your kids through college with. That very well might be the case. And it is likely that nobody ever will find out sometimes. We can see all these situations. I don't know what tempts you, but you do. We all know for ourselves. Let us be honest and clear. So the question then is, do you have faith? Do you see the reward? Or is your faith so small that the real reward that God is promising to His people who are faithful, who set aside the passing pleasures of sin, is your faith so small that that reward seems impossibly distant and uncertain and not real enough? I might get it, I might not. Who's to say? And that's years off. I mean, the reward that God gives us is when we die, right? We fall into that mode of thinking. The spiritual stuff only comes after death. I want heaven. Other stuff is, well, you know, figure it out until you get there. But as long as I'm okay when I die, well, then God will give me His stuff, His end of the bargain. Right now, I'm on me time. I'm going to figure this out on my own. Succumbing to temptation is always a matter of faith. It is always a matter of trusting God. For the person who at one point has trusted in the Lord and His promises, if we strengthen our faith, we strengthen our defenses. We come to realize that those things that are placed before us, those things that are presented to us in such a glittering golden light, are in fact passing and not worthy and not valuable. We look past them and instead decide that even the reproach of Christ, even the affliction we might suffer in this life, is better because we have a reward that is promised us by the God who calls us. A final consideration this morning. We need the faith of Moses when we recognize the need to listen to God. The Lord told Moses and the rest of Israel what He wanted them to do, how He wanted them to do it, when He wanted them to do it. We're talking here about verse 28 and describing the Passover that Moses and the children of Israel were to keep. Maybe it didn't make sense to them, as we've talked about. Again, there's nothing inherently logical or sensible about this. Putting blood over a doorpost, that would not seem on its own merits to have any effectiveness against death in the home. But it is what God ordered, and so by faith they listened and obeyed. Well, my question for us this morning, has God told us how to worship Him? Has God told us how to serve Him? Has God told us how we can be saved rather than destroyed? How we can be spared from destruction? I would answer to those questions in the affirmative. Yes, He's given us the necessary information on those things. The follow-up question then, do we sometimes as a race presume to come up with more logical, more marketable, more accessible, more modern, better ways of doing those things? Hopefully we see that this foolishness is no less than the foolishness of the Israelite family who on the night of that first Passover might have decided to go to bed and just said, yeah, right. Blood on the doorpost? Okay, that's going to work. We would look at that family with pity for their foolishness and for their lack of faith. That is no different from the one who lives today and says, worshiping God according to a New Testament pattern, that's archaic and kind of silly. Finding only one way to God through Jesus Christ, sounds kind of judgmental and limited. I think I'll figure out something that's a little more in line with my sensibilities. Being saved through the manner that God has prescribed? Well, okay, maybe you see it that way, but not me. That's simply, again, telling God, yeah, right, I'll figure this one out myself. Personally, I don't understand. why God would want to save people who have hated Him and cursed Him and sinned against Him and been violent towards Him, betrayed Him, lied to Him, turned away from Him, tried to use Him, and done all those things repeatedly. I don't understand fully why the method prescribed in the New Testament is the one that He went with. If the book of Acts is any help whatsoever, if the rest of the New Testament scriptures are of any use, I find that to be belief and repentance and baptism into Christ. I don't understand why He chose that method in entirety, but I do have faith. First, that He takes obedience seriously and that not obeying will not give me the results that I really want. And secondly, that He is just as serious about the reward and will absolutely live up to everything He has ever promised in His reward if I do those things that He has commanded me to do by faith. In conclusion this morning, consider that last verse of our text, verse 29. The Israelites and the Egyptians ultimately did the same thing. They did the very same thing. They, whether quickly or hesitantly, I don't know, again, the exact posture of every person who is venturing out into that dry land of the radically altered Red Sea, but they all put one foot after another, or led their animals, or drove their chariots or wagons, and ventured into the middle of the Red Sea on dry land. Israelite and Egyptian alike both did that very same action. The Israelites did so by faith and survived. The Egyptians did so for another reason, for any other reason. And to a man, they all perished. Those things that are possible only through faith are impossible without faith. Amen. If we are to be saved only through our faith in Christ, and outside of that there is no hope, then without faith in Him, it is impossible to be saved. Set aside the action itself for a moment. Faith defines it, decides whether or not it is worthy and effective. This morning we recommend obedience to God, but only to those who have faith. Baptism now saves us, Peter the Apostle writes, and the New Testament would inform us on several occasions, but millions of people this very day will take baths, will go swimming, might have an aquasize class at the local YMCA. They'll be getting immersed in the water. I want everyone here to obey the Lord because that is what we must do, but it is the obedience of true faith that He desires. The answer of a good conscience, as Peter goes on to describe that action. Have confidence that God can and will save, and this morning act in faith, act by faith, in obedience to Jesus Christ and His simple commands. If we can help you with that this morning, come forward right now while we're led in this song.